award-winning author Lois Lowry. This year marks the 25th anniversary of Lois Lowry's young adult novel, The Giver. It has won the Newbery Medal, been made into a movie, selected as one of the 100 most popular books in the Great American Read, and taught in countless middle school and high school classrooms. The Giver is just one of Lowry's more than 40 titles, and she continues to write. Now she's at work on a play from her home in Bridgeton, Maine. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on Maine Calling, Lois Lowry is our guest, and I'm joined by a guest host, Kennebunk High School junior, avid reader, and Lois Lowry fan, Ilona Bodwell. Have you read The Giver, Number the Stars, or the books in the Anastasia series? What are your questions for Lois Lowry? Maine Calling is next, but first, this news. From the Maine Public Radio studios, I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. Newbery Award-winning author Lois Lowry has written more than 40 books, one of which is the young adult novel The Giver. Lowry's dystopian young adult novel is a favorite among readers young and old. It marks its 25th anniversary this year. Today we'll talk about The Giver and about Lois Lowry's long writing career and what she's working on these days. Lois Lowry is here with me in the studio. I also have a guest host, a guest co-host. I've never done this before, Ilona. This is Ilona Bodwell, an avid reader and fan of Lowry's work, and is a junior at Kennebunk High School. As always, we want to hear from you. Do you have a favorite book by Lois Lowry? Did you or your kids read The Giver in school? What questions do you have for Lois about her life or her writing process? Our phone number 1-800-399-3566. You can send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to the Maine Calling Facebook page. Welcome to both of you. This program was originally scheduled for a month ago, but we were bumped by the Kavanaugh hearings, and I think that makes it maybe just a little bit sweeter that we are all here together today. But I want to start by asking you, Lois Lowry, about your path to becoming a writer. I understand that even though you've been writing since you were a child, it wasn't until you were in your 30s that you really became a serious writer.
Well, I wasn't not busy before I was in my 30s. I married very young. I had four children before I was 25, and so that kept me going, and it took me a while to get around. I had majored in writing in college, but you think you're going to write the great American novel, but when you're changing diapers on several babies simultaneously, it sort of puts the writing to the side. So I was 40 when my first book was published. Before that, I'd been a journalist, however.
You were? What kind of journalist? A newspaper reporter?
I did freelance photojournalism. Had a darkroom and everything. Those days are gone, the days of the darkroom.
And I understand some of the covers of some of your books are your photographs.
That's right. The Giver himself, that wonderful face. I had done that for a magazine article. He was long dead, but I had saved that photograph.
Oh, that's wonderful. And you didn't have a conventional childhood either, correct?
Well, what is a conventional childhood?
You didn't stay in one place for your...
No, my father was a career Army officer, so I was born in Hawaii. I have a birth certificate to prove it. And I spent my childhood in Pennsylvania during World War II when my father was overseas, and then went and lived in Japan at the end of the war when he had to stay there.
Okay, let's talk about The Giver because it's getting so much attention this year. First named for the Great American Read as one of the 100 most beloved novels in America, and celebrating its 25th anniversary a few years ago, a movie. For those of us who were not lucky enough to read it in middle school or high school of a certain age, give us a synopsis. What is The Giver about?
Oh, gosh, it's fairly simple. It's a boy turning 12 in a society very different from ours, set in some future time. We don't know how far in advance, maybe 50 years from now. Where the world is very different. And at age 12, all children are given their assignment for what they will be as adults. And he's singled out for a particular assignment, which is frightening and exhilarating at the same time, and I'm not going to give any more away than that.
Okay. Ilona Bodwell here as my co-host. How many times have you read The Giver?
I think I probably capped it off at around 12.
Why?
I don't know. I think I just like finally was like, well, now I can like guess what passage I'm going to read next because it's just like ingrained in my memory. So it's like, maybe I should just give it a little rest. But every year I try to read it at least once.
Have you read the ones that follow it?
Yeah. All of them like 12 times each.
Uh-huh,
yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
So here you are with your idol. What would you like to ask Lois Lowry?
I guess like school related, since I am in my junior year now, I've found that when I'm writing for my English class, I'm taking an IB English class, I have to put myself in like a certain headspace in order to be comfortable with like getting my thoughts out. So like, what's your favorite like place or headspace to be in when you're writing? Like,
I'm so old that I don't know what the phrase headspace means. But you know, I live alone most of the time, and I have a room where I work, and that's my space. Where my head is.
Mm-hmm.
And I think my books, my thoughts, my imagination, the stories I'm creating are there with me all the time. They're walking around with me all the mm-hmm. time. And then I go into that special room. I think it's important to have a space where you work if you're a writer. And that's where it all happens. It's just me and those characters who begin to seem very real to mm-hmm. me, I'm sure. I think that's true for readers as mm-hmm. well, that the characters begin to seem so
yeah.
real.
Like friends almost, mm-hmm. yeah.
Yeah, and you hate to say goodbye to them when you close the book.
Very.
Yeah.
You live in Maine. Does Maine affect your novels, affect your writing? Are you a different writer than you might be if you live somewhere else?
Well, I don't know that because I don't live someplace else, but I know I have, you know, I'm on the road a lot, and I'm just back this week from Europe, in fact, Iceland in September, Germany in October. And I work when I'm other places. I wrote one of the chapters of the book Gathering Blue, which is the one that immediately follows The Giver. I wrote that in an airport in Omaha, Nebraska. I was between planes, and my plane was delayed, and so I just opened my computer and wrote the next chapter.
God, I wish I could do that in just an airport.
Alona, do you have other questions for Lois?
Yeah, sure. So growing up, what was the book that made you fall in love with reading?
Oh, good question. And I probably would have several answers. But the one that always comes to my mind is The Yearling. Do you mm-hmm. know that book?
Yeah.
You know, it was published as an adult book. But my mother got it from the Book of the Month Club. I was about 8 years old, and she read it aloud to me. Of course, I read to myself at the same time. Mm-hmm. But mother, I don't know, she knew that that was a book we could share. And it changed my whole perception of literature. It was so real mm-hmm. Compared to the books I had loved prior to that, which were like Mary Poppins. A
mm-hmm.
Very different sort of book with tragedy in it. I'd never encountered that before because we all know Beth dies in Little Women, but mm-hmm. that's fake. I mean, it's a very romantic sort of death. The Yearling had real genuine tragedy in it, and it changed my way of thinking about what books could do and be.
You talk about how real that was, and that is what people talk about in your books, Lois mm-hmm. Lowry, is that really, really difficult things happen to young children, and some people are uncomfortable with that.
Oh, yeah. Ever since my very first book for kids, for young people, was published in 1977, and I can't do the math quickly. Yes, I can, because I was 40 when it was published, and I'm now 81. So that was 41 years ago. I had based it on an actual experience, the loss of my sister when we were both young. So it's a book, a realistic book, about written as fiction, but it's about the death of a young girl, told from the point of view of the younger sister. That was unusual then. Since that time, books have become more hard-hitting, I think, but that was not true then, except it was the same year that Katherine Patterson, who's now a friend of mine, had written Bridge to Terabithia and won the Newbery Medal for another book about, a realistic book about the death of a young person.
And now we have, The Giver is in the category of dystopian fiction. Now we have, of course, The Hunger Games.
Oh, and a whole lot of others.
Mm-hmm.
Dystopian fiction has been around for a long time. I remember reading 1984, Brave New World, when I was in college, majoring in English. But the book that I loved in that genre was The Handmaid's Tale, which I read as a young housewife. But The Giver was apparently the first dystopian fiction published for young people. And it became so popular that many, many other books followed it, some of them very, very good. I think that time has passed now and other things are going to take their place as trends. But for a while there, every book you saw was dystopian.
Mm-hmm. Ilona?
Yeah, I definitely went through like a big dystopian phase. I think your book probably was the thing that caused me to want to enter that genre. And I was reading a lot of Hunger Games, and I read like the Divergent series, mm-hmm. which was great. But I'm excited for like, I feel like there's like a new age of books, like realistic fiction books for younger people that is starting to make its way into like the bookstore. And I'm excited to see like the change, because I think the dystopian is
its time has passed.
It's important to read books like that, I think. But I think I'm excited for new books to come out.
What's your favorite new, brand new one?
I haven't been reading very many new books. I've pretty much just been reading in class. But my favorite, like, there's this magazine called Rookie that I'm really into, and I hope to, like, work there someday. It's amazing. But they have a lot of, like, interviews with people that I love to read. So I think I read Rookie like almost every day. Like I read a new interview or like a discussion about like gender or something like that.
Oh, that's great to know. I never heard of Rookie.
It's very cool.
Look it up.
It's very cool.
Lois, we'll talk about The Great American Read. How did you find out that The Giver was named one of the 100 most beloved books in America?
Yeah, that was quite astonishing. Actually, my publisher, Houghton Mifflin Harcourt, my editor called me. They were very excited. They had three books on the list. Let me think of what they were. The Little Prince is a Houghton book, mine, and there was another, and I'm forgetting which one it was. It's an interesting list. And, of course, the final vote has just been tallied, and To Kill a Mockingbird is the most beloved book in the United States, deservedly, I think. The Giver was number 44, which is not a bad place to be out of 100.
Not bad at all.
No. Came in higher than War and Peace.
Crazy.
And the whole idea, I mean, this renewed attention, I know it sort of comes in waves, but this renewed attention, what has that meant to you?
Well, for one thing, with the 25th anniversary of the publication of The Giver coming up this year, they asked me to, they were going to put out a new edition, I don't know what they call it, an anniversary edition, I guess. And so they asked me to write some additional material. And I took that invitation as a way of addressing the question I am most frequently asked and which has not been adequately answered, and that is, what happened to the community after the boy fled? The three books that follow The Giver deal with the people who are in the books, what happened to them, but it does not go back to the community. And so many kids have asked me that. I'm not going to write a whole other book about it, but in the new afterword to the anniversary edition, it does try to divulge a little bit about what happened afterward.
Mm. Ilona, what do you think happened afterward?
I don't think I ever questioned it that much. I kind of loved the sense of ambiguity that you left at the end, because it allowed me to like both wonder more and also just like be like, okay, it's just like it's kind of over now, and like I've made my peace with like the end of the series. But
when I wrote the first book, I left the ending ambiguous on purpose. I liked that ambiguity. Kids did not. You were an exception.
Yeah.
And so I began getting first angry letters and then emails. I mean, the book is old enough now that at first it was actual snail mail that came in. The email still comes, and kids wanted a more definitive answer to what happened at the end. And so eventually I went on to write the other three books. But I did like the ambiguity.
It's interesting looking at The Giver through the lens of today's times. And I've read it, Lois, I told you, 4 years ago, but flipping through it again this morning, thinking about really the themes of how we deal with people who are different than we are, the definition of the other, so relevant today, possibly even more relevant than when you wrote The Giver.
Yeah, it's been interesting and disturbing in a way to realize how in this current world, in this current political climate, so many things are happening that are analogous to things in dystopian books of all kinds, The Handmaid's Tale as well.
Yeah.
Well, I won't go on politically because I could get on a rant.
I'm
and
ready.
This is not the time
do
to
it.
Do that.
You can say whatever
but
you want. You're Lois Lowry.
let me just point out one thing that I mentioned already, that I grew up in a military family, that my father was a career Army officer. So I grew up on military posts, and I think that was the origin, subconsciously, of the community that I created in The Giver, because that was the way I lived. The houses were the same. People with high rank had a better house. It was very orderly, very safe, very comfortable, and in retrospect, very creepy.
Mm. Interesting. Mm-hmm. Alona?
Yeah. Do you think that maybe the dystopian is something that, like, we've already experienced, and, like, now that it's happening more and more, we're starting to realize it? Like, I was thinking about how in the book there's a couple passages that are about how the certain babies that, like, maybe cry too much are, you know, I won't try to spoil anything, but great stuff doesn't happen to them. And, like, if you're looking back into, like, the 60s and the 50s, like, thinking about all the treatments that were being done on, like, people with mental health issues and, like, mental disabilities, but now we're starting to see it again. Like, do you think that you were writing out of, like, a sense of need for security?
Well, interesting question, and it's hard to go back into my brain when I was writing the book, and most of that comes out of my subconscious anyway, I think. But I did try when I wrote The Giver. I remember trying when I was writing the beginning of it to lull the reader, to seduce the reader into thinking this was a great world.
Mm-hmm.
And then I tried to find ways to, with subtlety, I hope it's subtle, to let the reader begin to be uncomfortable and not know why exactly. So it's quite a while into the book that you realize what seems so lovely has an underbelly.
Yeah. It seems like that's what conformity will do to us, is, like, as a society, if you look at the movie adaptation of the book, like, the grayness of it all is, like, the part that's hurting people instead of helping them.
When I wrote the book, it took me a while to realize that there wasn't any color.
Mm-hmm.
And then I had to go back and rewrite and remove any reference to color in the beginning.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not giving away for too much for people who haven't read it, but the people in the book have been bred, or however it has come about, so that they don't see color and everything is gray. Then the one boy begins gradually to see color.
I see it. Yep.
And I was very pleased that they were able to do that in the movie. They began trying to make the movie many years earlier, at a time when it would have been more difficult to do that saturation of color gradually.
It was very visually pleasing. I loved that part of it. I was like, this is exactly what I was picturing as I was, like, you know, like 10 years old, like reading this book.
Goodness. We have to take a break. Okay. We're speaking with Lois Lowry and special co-host Alona Bodwell. When we come back, your comments and questions, our phone number, 1-800-399-3566. Again, 1-800-399-3566. Send an email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. We'll be right back.
You make Maine Calling possible, as do Anthem Blue Cross and Blue Shield, committed to driving transformation for a healthier future for the people of Maine, anthem.com. And Norris, helping businesses and schools stay safe through engineered security, life safety, and emergency communications systems, norrisinc.com.
The Democratic nominee for governor in Illinois has contributed more money to his own campaign than any other candidate in history. Some voters don't like that.
It's just distressing where you see these figures, and I just feel like it makes people think that their democracy really isn't for them anymore.
Money in Illinois politics, plus the latest on suspicious packages sent at prominent Democrats, this afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Join us this afternoon from 4 to 6:30 here on Maine Public Radio. Election Day is approaching, and Maine Public News has much of what you need to be informed about the candidates and the issues we'll be voting on in November. It's all at mainepublic.org/yourvote. You'll find analysis of the important issues, in-depth interviews and profiles of the candidates for governor, Senate, and our two congressional districts, our Maine Calling candidate programs, and our schedule of upcoming debates, which will also be available for on-demand as soon as they happen. All this and more at mainepublic.org/yourvote, or click on the Your Vote banner on the mainepublic.org homepage.
Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Here in the studio with me today, acclaimed author Lois Lowry. She's the Newbery Award-winning author of Number the Stars and The Giver, and has more than 40 books, 40 titles for young readers. And Ilona Bodwell is a high school student and fan of Lowry's work. We invite you to join the conversation. Call 1-800-399-3566. Send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. Got an email this morning. My name is Kaylee Disher, and I am an ELA teacher at Princeton Elementary School in Princeton, Maine. That's far down east for those of you who don't know. My 7th and 8th grade class is currently reading Lois Lowry's The Giver. We're on chapter 5. My kids are very into the book. We are reading the book with the big idea in mind that societal structure had the power to limit or promote freedom, choice, and desire. So we have some questions from Ms. Disher and from the students, but I want to ask you before that, what you think, Lois, of the fact that your book has been used in so many classrooms in these 25 years?
It's amazing. I mean, not only across this country, but the book has been published in something like 40 other languages. And so kids everywhere are reading this book and thinking about the same questions. I think that's got to be a good thing, that it's become worldwide and that mm-hmm. kids can discuss something across cultures.
Okay, so I'm going to try a couple of the questions. The first is from Ms. Disher. Do you think we, American culture and society, is closer to or further from becoming the community than when you wrote The Giver?
Oh, boy, that's a tough one. And I'm curious to hear what Ilona would think. I'm passing the buck,
okay.
Aren't I?
Okay. I take a sociology class at my school that's a college class that I've been taking, and it's definitely making me question, like, more and more the society that I find myself in. And just from how I grew up in, you know, Kennebunk, Maine, which is, you know, well known for the bushes and lobster. And I find myself constantly surrounded by, don't get me wrong, like, I have some of the most, like, amazing friends and really truly amazing teachers, but I find that conformity is so important if you're going to have an easy time at the school I go to.
But I'll tell you a secret, Ilona. That was true when I was your age, too. I think maybe that's the symptom of adolescence, the desire to be like others. Well, secretly, you know inside yourself that you're not. Mm-hmm. But there's a lot of push toward conformity at that age.
Yeah.
Maybe more so now than when I was young, but I suspect not.
No, I think there is. I feel a pressure myself. Thankfully, I feel comfortable enough in myself that I don't have to do it, but, like, to dress a certain way and to take certain classes and be part of certain clubs. But, like, here I am, like, in feminist club and, like, in environmental action team and, like, all of this stuff that is kind of straying away from that path.
I had to be in the hostess club when I was in high school.
Ooh.
We were taught how to set tables beautifully.
Nope.
So things have progressed in good ways, I think.
Yeah, great ways.
So some of these questions you've already answered. Michaela Howard at grade 7 wants to know if a real town or place inspired you and if you've ever lived in a utopian society. You answered that. You
answered
said kind
that,
of
yes.
like growing up on a military base. How about Deck and Saka Base in grade 8? Why would someone want to live in a community like The Giver?
Well, as I said a minute ago, I tried to make it seem at first to be very appealing. And I think the things I tried to make be appealing were the fact that they were very comfortable.
Mm.
They were very safe. There was no crime in that community. There was no money. You didn't have to grapple with things like that. No competition. So I think that's a desirable set of circumstances in the eyes of most people. We'd like to live in a safe, comfortable community. Of course, the price they paid, the compromises they made were very expensive ones, and you learn that as you read along.
Braden, Richard, grade 8, asked two questions. I know the first one is not one of your favorite ones, but several kids are asking it. How did you come up with the idea for The Giver?
It's not that I don't like the question. It's just that I've been asked it so often, and there you can't come up with a new answer every time. I was impatient. I was beginning to be impatient with it a few years ago, and then my own granddaughter asked it of me, and I realized, oh, every kid who asks it, it's the first time they've asked it, even though I've answered it 1,000 times. And the problem is I don't have a good answer. Ideas come from lots of different places. However, at that particular time, my father was getting very old and was in not a nursing home, but an assisted living place. And I would go down to visit him in Virginia every 6 weeks or so, and I became aware on one visit that he had forgotten certain things. We went through a photograph album, and there were pictures of me and my sister as toddlers and small children and teenagers. I realized that he had forgotten my sister. She had died young. And so when he said to me, oh, there you are with your sister, and then he said, I can't remember her name, and I had to tell him. And then he said, whatever happened to her? And I had to tell him that she had died. That was difficult. But it made me think, when I was driving my rental car back to the airport after that visit, what if there were a way that people could just erase or have erased any painful or sad memories that they have? Would that be a good thing? And, of course, when a writer starts thinking something that begins with what if, it starts to turn into a story. And that was really the origin of The Giver.
Braden, second part of his question, what is your favorite part of the book? And why? And then he says, remember, we're only on chapter 5.
Oh, dear. And I don't want to give anything away for the kids. I don't remember what happens at chapter 5, how far they've gotten. But I can identify my favorite passage. Perhaps I've thought about it lately because the graphic novel is about to come out. And although I haven't met the artist, the illustrator, I did get a glimpse of the first drawings that he had made, and I was able to put in some thoughts of my own, and he had left out one of my favorite passages. Of course, there wasn't room to put in every single thing in the book, so at my request, he put it back in, and that's the passage in which the boy discovers for the first time by seeing a memory of it, a Christmas celebration, and he sees a family and realizes that the family has feelings of affection to one another, something he has not experienced yet. And that was my favorite passage.
We'll go to Logan, who's calling from Falmouth Middle School. Hi, Logan. Go ahead. You're on Main Calling with Lois Lowry.
Hi. We're reading The Giver right now, and I had a question. Are any of the characters in The Giver based on people that you've met in real life?
Not specifically, and yet when you're writing fictional characters, when you're making people up, of course they're all based on people you've known, and they're based a little bit on yourself too, I think. Even though Jonas in the book is a boy, I saw a lot of myself in him, I think. And The Giver himself, the picture on the cover was a real man whom I knew, and I took that photograph of him. So he was in my mind, I think, when I created the character of The Giver. Then, of course, if you see the movie Forever After, you see Jeff Bridges instead of the man in my photograph. But nobody is explicitly a real person.
Logan, thanks for your question. We have an email from Daniel. I'm a 7th grade student. I was just wondering, how many rejections did you get before The Giver was accepted?
Well, I was fortunate because I had published a number of books before then. I don't know how many, but let's say 15. All of them with the same publisher and the same editor. And so when I wrote The Giver, even though it was very different from my previous books, it was that editor that I gave it to, and it was he who published it. So it was not rejected at all.
Do you remember what he said when he first read it, given that it was very different than your other books?
He was startled by it and puzzled a little. And, of course, this was a first draft that I gave him. It went through a lot of changes. He had always before, it had been just he and I working on a book together. This time he gave it to three other editors. And somewhere, well, I know where it is, actually, there is a letter in which he incorporates all of their thoughts about it. Of course, it did go on to be published, but they raised a lot of questions that I hadn't adequately dealt with. And I think he was intrigued by it and excited by it, would be my best description of his.
Did you have a sense when you finished of what it would become? Did you think to yourself, you know what, I have done something really different here?
Well, I knew it was different, but there's no way that you can predict the reaction of readers and of the audience. So I didn't have a clue what would happen afterward. That was astonishing, and it remains astonishing. Almost immediately, it attracted an audience that I never had before. Not only kids, which had always been my audience, but suddenly I was getting letters from presidents of corporations, from a Qantas pilot, from a prison, from all sorts of people, a Trappist monk. And so something in that book reached out and spoke to a broad spectrum of people, and I could not have anticipated that, nor could I have planned it.
Mm. We'll go to Diego, who's calling from Sanford. Hi, Diego. Go ahead. You're on Main Calling.
Hi, Jennifer. Hi, Lois. I'm thrilled. Okay.
We're thrilled to have you call.
I read this book back in the 90s when my oldest boy brought it home from school, and I believe he was in middle school, maybe eighth or grade or whatever. Then my daughter read it a year or two later, and then my youngest son read it when he was in high school about six or seven years ago. So I read it again. Anyway, the thing that so impressed me and just blew my mind was the fact that what it is that they're demanding this young man to do is a concept which is actually happening in our world today.
Okay. You want to be a little more specific?
Sure. He's taking basically carrying the cares of the world.
Yeah, and there are those who have given that religious significance and have likened him to a savior or a sacrificial.
Right, but that always happens. But the part that I felt was really an incredible insight was the fact that he has to carry this by himself, that everybody else gives it up, and they don't have to deal with these woes. They're giving him, you know.
That's right, piling it on. Well, you know, scapegoating has taken place.
The world. Yeah. So.
It's throughout history there have been scapegoats, and I guess Jonas could be portrayed that way.
One of the questions from the class in Princeton from K.O. Myers is, what is Jonas's father's name?
You know, it's interesting. I get emails still every day from kids, and somebody asked me that recently. I don't think the same kid who just asked it of you. And the fact is, Jonas's father and mother do not have names in the book, so I can't answer that.
All right. We will go to Rick, who's calling from Falmouth. Hi, Rick. Go ahead.
Hi. I'm wondering if Ms. Lowry has seen the finished version of the graphic novel of The Giver, what she thinks of graphic novels generally, and what her attitude if the editor asked for changes in her manuscripts that she doesn't agree with. Thank you.
Okay, that's several questions. Yes, I have seen the finished graphic novel. It's fabulous. I have not met the illustrator. His name is Craig Russell, but he's top-notch, and I think kids will love it. What I think of graphic novels in general, you know, I grew up in a world where comic books were part of my life. Little Lulu was my favorite. And I think there's always been a place for the visual. And some kids are going to gravitate to that kind of book. It's interesting how popular graphic novels have become. There was another question. Oh, what happens if they ask for changes in a manuscript and I don't agree with? I have a good relationship with my editor. I had one editor for my first zillion, and then he retired, and I've had another editor for the book since then. And in both cases, They don't so much ask for changes as raise questions that haven't been adequately addressed. And that, to me, is a good thing. It makes me go back and work a little harder and make the book a little better. I'm grateful for that.
Rick, thank you so much for your question. We're going to take a quick break, but first a word about tomorrow's program. Join me for a conversation about the world of antiques in Maine. If you'd like, you can email your comments or questions ahead of time. Meantime, we're speaking with author Lois Lowry today. Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566. This is Maine Calling.
You make Maine Calling possible, as do Houston & Company, celebrating 30 years of fine furniture making, showroom and workshop in Kennebunkport, and online at houstonandcompany.com. And Otelco, formerly OTT Communications, from phones to fiber, serving Maine businesses for more than a century, otelco.com.
I'm Marco Werman. So many stories unfolding.
I would not be at all surprised if there were more packages in circulation from this sender. And then,
on The World, we keep you up to date.
The migrants are walking towards the further north town.
We bring you insights.
A lot of the migrants are skeptical about applying for asylum in Mexico, and there's some good reasons for that.
Join us on The World.
Coming up this afternoon at 3 o'clock here on Maine Public Radio. And after Maine Calling at 2 o'clock, it's the Commonwealth Club of California. CNN political analyst April Ryan, who has previously worked as a White House correspondent since 1997, discusses her new book, Under Fire, Reporting from the Front Lines of the Trump White House. Again, that's coming up shortly at 2 o'clock here on Maine Public Radio.
Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You're listening to Maine Calling. Today on the program, we are talking with Lois Lowry. She's the author of many beloved novels and books for young readers. Also with me, Ilona Bodwell, Kennebunk High School junior with a strong interest in young adult literature and Lois Lowry's work. Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566. We have a tweet from Susan Ross, who's a Maine author and writing teacher. She says, Lois Lowry is my author crush hero. Love The Giver and Number the Stars inspired me to write Searching for Lottie. So there you go.
That's great.
Ilona?
So who are the people in your life that, you know, you were talking about how you started writing when you were 30, and that's like really when you got into it other than majoring in college, but like when you started publishing books was when you were 30.
I was 40 actually.
You were 40.
When my first
really?
Book was published, yeah.
That's crazy. Who were like the people in your life that made you want to keep writing and made you keep at it and were teachers for you?
I had a wonderful professor in college at Brown who Charles Philbrick was his name. He's long dead, but he was the one who told me that I could be a writer. And I remember him very fondly for that. But then I, you know, spent a number of years with a house full of babies. Mm-hmm. I didn't have people in my life who were giving me mm-hmm. that other part that I was missing. And it was, so, and plus which, I'm an introvert, and I'm very introspective. And writing is an introspective profession. It wasn't until later, after my first book was published, and then my second and third and 10th and 12th, that I began to develop a community of writing pals, which I still mm-hmm. have. And they're very important to me, but they weren't around when I was starting out. They were around in their own place, and we were not connected yet.
Mm-hmm. Are there other, like, who are your author friends now that just, like, make you want to work extra, extra hard on writing?
You know, I don't need friends for that.
No.
I work extra, extra hard just on my own. But you might recognize some names. My author friends tend to be getting older now, but mm-hmm. they've been around for a while. Do you know the name Phyllis Reynolds Naylor?
I think so, yeah.
Okay. I got an email from her yesterday. She and I are close friends. I mm-hmm. mentioned Catherine Patterson.
Yeah.
And so many. There are mm-hmm. so many wonderful writers out there. And a whole lot of new young ones whom mm-hmm. I haven't met.
Very exciting.
We're going to go to Clara Jean, who's calling from the Paul School in Wakefield, New Hampshire. Hi, Clara. Go ahead.
Hi. Why are the stuffed animals in The Giver imaginary?
Okay, now I have to think back. I haven't read The Giver in a long time. Why are the stuffed animals imaginary? Okay. Each child in The Giver is given a stuffed animal when they are a baby, and it's called a comfort object. And Jonas's little sister has one. But the children have to relinquish those, have to turn them in when they reach a certain age. When you say they're imaginary, they're not really. They're an actual stuffed animal. But the children in the giver, in the world of the giver, do not know that there are real animals, because in their world, animals have become obsolete. And it's only when Jonas begins to understand what the real world once was that he realizes his sister's stuffed elephant represents something that had once been a real and magnificent creature. So in that sense, I guess they are imaginary to the children who now have them. They're simply a lump of fur with a face.
Clara, did you read The Giver, the whole book?
We're just starting it.
Okay.
And now I've ruined part of it for you by giving things away. I'm sorry.
Well, have a wonderful experience. We're going to go to an email from Rowan in the seventh grade. Who is your favorite author and what genre do they specialize in?
Oh, dear. you know, I'm...
The kids are asking the tough questions,
yes,
aren't they?
Yes, they are. I'm, you know, an old lady now, and I don't read children's books. So my authors, my favorites, are not the same ones as yours, because you're young and you're reading books for young people.
I think our adult listeners would like to know who your
favorite
authors are.
Okay, one of my current favorite authors is Ian McEwan. I also love Margaret Atwood, although I haven't loved all of her books. I haven't loved all of Ian McEwan's either. But there are two names for you.
Maxine says, thank you for your writing. I loved The Giver and Gathering Blue. And Leah is also in middle school. Was writing the sequel to The Giver different than writing The Giver? In what way?
Okay, that's an interesting question. When I began writing the book, which ended up being called Gathering Blue, I did not know that it was going to be related to The Giver. Kids had been writing to me, asking for more books to follow The Giver, but I had said that I wasn't going to. And then I began to start a book, the way I always do, with a character who appears in my imagination. In this case, it was a young girl. And in a situation that's kind of mysterious. Always that's the way a book begins in my mind. So I saw this girl in a very primitive, horrible place, and I began to write the book, and it was clear she lived in a place where there was no advanced civilization at all. There's no electricity. There's no plumbing. She lives in a hut. And I began to think it was almost prehistoric. I was afraid I was going to have to do research on woolly mammoths. And yet, suddenly, as I was writing the book, I realized that this could be another community, separate from the one where Jonas lives, but related to it. And so it then became a book related to The Giver, and I mentioned Jonas on the last pages, not by name, although when I wrote the book, his name was mentioned.
Hmm.
And it was the editor who asked me to take the name out so that people who hadn't read the first book wouldn't be puzzled by it. So it's just mentioned a boy with blue eyes. Mm-hmm. And everybody who read The Giver knew that it was Jonas. But that's how it began, as a completely separate individual book.
What's next for you?
What's next for me is completely unlike The Giver. And it's always exhilarating for an author, I think, to write something that is not like what you've written 10 times before. And it's a complex book, so I'll make this as brief as possible. But I was born, because of my father's profession, in Hawaii. And no television in those days, but my dad had a movie camera. And when I was growing up, it was exciting in the evening to have Dad show the old home movies. So I had seen them a zillion times. And it wasn't until I was an adult and watched once again, because I was transferring the movies to videotape, the scene of baby Lois toddling on the beach at Waikiki. And it's a lovely scene with the waves lapping at the shore. But a friend who was there noticed something that I had never noticed and pointed it out. And he was a friend who had graduated from Annapolis. He said, look, On the Horizon. And that's the name of the new book, On the Horizon. And there, shrouded in mist, but clearly the shape is visible, is a battleship. And my friend John said, that's the Arizona.
Mm.
So here's baby Lois cheerfully playing with her shovel on a beach, and on the horizon is a ship containing 1,200 young men, and within months, all of them will be dead. Once I knew that, I couldn't figure out what to do with that knowledge, but it has haunted me for some years. And that's what the new book is about the relationship that we have to each other, the relationship of the child on the beach to the boys on that boat, and more and more and more it goes on from there.
So it's unlike anything you've ever written, but like it in that it's about the relationship
of human beings to one another and how our fates are intertwined, yes.
Alona?
Yeah. As you're, you know, seeing the news more and more, have there been any topics or big stories that have inspired your writing?
Interesting question. And it brings something to my mind. The fourth book in the Giver series is called Son, S-O-N. It began when I was going to write about the baby, Gabriel, from the first book as an adolescent, because people had asked, whatever happened to the baby? So I began by writing about him and what was he looking for in life, and he was about 14. And he asks Jonas, who is an adult then, what about my mother? Who was my mother? Didn't she want me? And I began to think about that mother, and I went back and redid the book and started again with a young girl, 14 years old, giving birth to a child who will be taken from her. Okay, so that the book is her search for her son, who turns out to be Gabe, and it takes many years, 14 years. But during the time I was writing it, I was thinking about something. This is in answer to your question about new from the news. Back when my kids were young in Maine, some people listening might remember this. It was a Labor Day weekend. The newspaper was suddenly filled with a child who had been camping with his parents in northern Maine. They packed up to leave at the end of the Labor Day weekend, and they couldn't find their four-year-old boy. It all played out with dogs being brought in, helicopters, game wardens, state police, all the things you would expect. It was September. It was northern Maine. It got colder and colder, and they could not find that child. And eventually, those parents had to pack their car and leave and go back to Massachusetts without him. And he was never, ever found. His name was Kurt Newton. There was a photograph of him in the paper that looked like my own little boy. Mm-hmm. So I've never forgotten that and the sense of what it would be like to not know where your child is. And that was the sense that drove the plot through Son as Claire looks for that baby she's lost.
Mm. I read that you've also recently completed a play that touches on the topic of gun violence.
Oh, dear. Not completed. It's much in progress because I took on a project that is so difficult. I was commissioned by a theater director to write a play, and it's about teenage gun violence. It's been workshopped in New York, which made us aware that it needed more work, and so that's what I've been working on. But it'll be a while till it achieves the final shape, simply because every day with new news, everything shifts and changes in that whole terrible world.
Charlie, who's also in middle school, says, was there anyone you looked up to when becoming an author?
Oh, many people, I think. And the one who comes to my mind immediately is a friend of my grandfather's. My grandfather was a bank president in Pennsylvania. He had a friend. I thought of him as an old man. Now I realize my grandfather and his friend were probably 60, if that. But at any rate, his friend was an unmarried man who was a Pennsylvania judge whose last name was Biddle. And he took a great liking to me because I was a literary child. I was a toddler who liked books and poetry. And this lovely man used to send me a book on my birthday for years and years. And when I was in Brown as a student, he died. And he left one half of 1% of his estate to the little girl who had recited Thanatopsis while wearing her pajamas in my grandmother's living room. That, of course, was me. So I have a great fondness for him and the conversations we used to have about books, this old man and this very little girl who both loved the same things.
Dorothy, the librarian at Greeley Middle School, says that she asked her sixth graders what they wanted to ask, and here's a question about a different book. How did you think of such crazy characters in Goonie Bird, and what was the inspiration for her name? So,
Her name just came to me. I don't have a way of explaining that. Sometimes things just appear, but I can tell you the inspiration. Goonie Bird is in the second grade, and the series of books are all set in a second grade classroom. I went to first grade in Pennsylvania, and I could already read long before I began school, and they didn't quite know what to do about that. So at the end of first grade, they put me in third grade, but all my friends went to second grade. And every day I had to pass that second grade classroom, which was taught by a woman named Mrs. Tay, T-A-Y, who lived on a farm. And every spring she took that whole second grade out to ride the ponies on her farm, and I never got to go because I was in third grade with a terrible, grouchy teacher. So I've always had this feeling that I missed something wonderful in second grade, and I wanted to go back there. So I created the second grade classroom. And also, I was a very shy, introverted child who desperately wanted to be the outgoing, popular one, which I wasn't. And so I created that character who arrives as a new student after school has already begun, enters the classroom wearing pajamas and cowboy boots and says, I want a desk right smack in the middle of everything. That's the child I wanted to be.
Alona, we have time for one more question. What's your big question for Lois Lowry?
Okay.
No pressure. No,
what
do you still really want to know?
I guess this is more for something I've always wanted to know personally is, you know, I love to read, but I don't think I've ever been much of a writer. But for you being a writer, what's your other favorite art form in which you, like, love to express yourself?
Not that I can do it, but I love movies. I'm mm-hmm. a great movie fan. I go to every movie. I'm probably the only person over 50 who saw Wayne's World 2.
Even I didn't see that. Goodness.
You know, I grow flower gardens and knit sweaters mm-hmm. and do things that end up, I hope, looking colorful mm-hmm. and wonderful. Those are my pleasures. Mm-hmm. And I cook. I like to cook.
I like to eat.
And we just have a few seconds that I want to ask you. I've asked every author who's been on the program what their habit is. Everybody except Richard Ford has told me that he or she writes every day. Do you write every day or pretty much every day?
Pretty much. It's not always creative writing or a chapter of a novel. Sometimes it's letters to friends. But just putting words on a page is what keeps me going every day.
Mm. Well, thank you so much. How much fun. Lois Lowry, the award-winning author of more than 40 books for young adults and children. Her young adult novel, The Giver, is celebrating its 25th anniversary this year. I guess it's not celebrating. We're all celebrating it. Alona Bodwell is an avid reader and student at Kennebunk High School. Sandra Harris ran the board today. Maine Calling is produced by Jonathan Smith and Cindy Hahn. Tomorrow on the program, Antiquing in Maine. A quick reminder, you can find Maine Calling's Your Vote candidate interviews at mainepublic.org. I'm Jennifer Rooks, and you've been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.